resurrected the House Committee on Health Care to order. Today, we start what I hope will be a journey in the interim, extent to which this committee, in its this form or in some other form, moves forward into the interim, to look at the question of health licensing boards, and particularly to look at the extent to which the system is set up in a way that the boards can adequately deal with the conflicting responsibility they have. On the one hand, the boards have a responsibility to protect the public. On the other hand, the boards have a responsibility to protect the professionals. And how they manage that somewhat conflicting responsibility, and particularly how the structure of the system affects their ability to deal with that in some systematic and logical way, is something we're going to be looking at. There's been some recent notoriety around the nursing board, so it made sense for us to at least kick off today's discussion with looking at the events over the last 18 months or so relative to the nursing board, with the hope that not that we'll stir up a lot of trouble and create a lot of sensation. There are reporters doing that as it is, and they'll take care of that. But the extent to which we can see how what's happened in the nursing board is instructive of the extent to which we need to change the system, change the statutes, change the relationship between the nursing board and other pieces of the healthcare system to instruct us on the journey as we go forward over the interim. So let me invite Ree Saylor to join us to give a little bit of overview from the governor's perspective, or from the perspective of the governor's office.
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ree Saylors. I am Governor Kulongoski's health policy advisor, and I'm pleased to be before you today. As Representative Greenlick indicated, I think this is the beginning of us looking down a path and examining the structures that we have in the state to try and pull off the balancing act that he discussed. On behalf of the governor, I'd like to applaud you for opening this look at this initiative to look at licensing boards in general. I think it's timely, and also I think it's important that we look periodically at these systems that we've put in motion to make sure they're still doing what we hope they would do in the first place. It is a very complex area with respect to policy and public policy, and it also is a ticklish area because there are issues of due process, there are issues of confidentiality that spread to the patients who may be involved, the disciplinary actions that are taken, and some of the programs that are available for providers. And so our ability to talk about this publicly is sometimes constrained by some of that confidentiality, but we are also have launched, due to the recent articles, our own review of, particularly in this case, the Board of Nursing. And I wanted to recount for you some of the things that we've done already, and then maybe pose a couple of questions that might be policy questions that we might look at as we go down the road. The recent case that was written up in the Portland Tribune involved a case with the Board of Nursing. Since that time, I wanted you to know that we have taken this quite seriously in our office and have begun a series of actions that we've taken. We brought in, asked members of the staff of the State Board of Nursing, members of the staff in the Department of Human Services, the administrator for the Criminal Backgrounds Check Unit and DHS, and attorneys for the board also to come and talk with us. We have also called in members of the board, not the entire membership, but a number of the members of the board to have discussions with them about not just this case, but their overall system and processes. We've contracted with an expert whose background is in regulatory work with the Department of Human Services, a retiree who is available to us, who has extensive experience in the area of nursing homes and also adult abuse investigations. And we are also using the internal investigator in DHS to assist that consultant in terms of linkages between the Department of Human Services and the licensing boards and disciplinary action, et cetera. We've also spoken with the daughter of the victim in this particular case. I just had a phone call with her less than an hour ago where we talked about this, and I think on her behalf, I think her message to this committee would be, and as her mother said to her, just make sure this doesn't happen to another family. I think part of what we've looked at is, and also I would add that we had met with the board staff and spoken with members of the board, and consequently I think we also saw them move for an emergency board meeting on the weekend and to have the license of the individual in question under emergency suspension so that they were not able to find work elsewhere. This particular case, without going into the details, it has some lessons in it, and that is a kind of what we would describe as sort of a bad marriage between maybe an institution that maybe didn't do its full responsibilities with an individual seeking employment there and who had been subject to disciplinary action also. We've learned a lot just in the last 2 weeks, quite frankly, in terms of how some of the systems work. Our consultant is going to look at their statutes, their rules, their procedures, their guidelines, try and identify gaps that we have, and see what actions need to be taken to improve this system. The governor believes that these licensing boards are there to assure the public that the people who treat them are competent and capable of handling the treatment they are held responsible for, and we want to make sure that the public confidence is buoyed by our efforts together. We would offer assistance from the Office of the Governor, Representative Greenlick, to your committee in any way that we can be helpful to you. I think some of the issues are, some of the questions I think that you have to ask in looking at licensing boards are, to what degree do we expect the board members to be directly involved in certain types of cases? To what degree do we delegate issues to staff? What are the criteria by which issues float up to the boards for consideration? If you have, for instance, an impaired practitioner, should there be sort of a stepped-up type of monitoring that checks in more assertively rather than reactively with that individual? Those are some of preliminary questions that I think are in my own mind as we've gone through some of the issues we've looked at over the last few weeks, and which I think can generically apply to any of the boards, not just the Board of Licensing. So I think that's part of it, and I think the linkages between the providers, the agency responsible for licensing facilities, the licensure boards who are responsible for the professionals, and also the employer who is involved in terms of their decision-making and their responsibilities as well. I think initially I kind of drew it as a, in my own mind, as a triangle between, you know, DHS, the licensing boards, and the employer, and I realized we also needed to add the patient in there as well, too. So I would offer, again, our full cooperation with you and applaud your judgment to take a look at these things. And I think we're looking forward to the interim and hopefully working together with you.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Hanna?
Ms. Hanna, you said that a retired DHS person has been hired. Who is that person and what's their background?
Her name is Cindy Hannum. She was formerly the head of the unit in DHS that does nursing home licensure and adult abuse investigations.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Roll with you.
I'm interested in what the governor's office is doing in this regard. Has there been discussion about the appropriateness of having the board be responsible for licensing and for investigation and follow-up on complaints? And I mean, is there not kind of an inherent conflict of interest? This has kind of come up in some other situations that we've considered, and it was compared to what is happening in the Bar Association, where you have the PLF that tries to avoid liability and provides care for drug and alcohol related, and I mean they go out of their way to try and correct problems, but they're separate from the State Bar Association. But because if a complaint goes to the Bar Association, then it's an investigation. But if they were together, you have this problem like the Board of Medical Examiners is trying to deal with, as far as, is this something we should help with, or is this something that's affecting their ability to practice medicine? I'm wondering if you're looking at all at the structure, just inherently.
Chairman Greenlee, Representative Richardson, yes, I think that's an inherent question about the licensing boards across the boards, excuse the expression. And that is there a conflict of interest, and is the board capable of handling both? One of the things I will say is that the disciplinary cases that I've had the opportunity to look at and the board activity that I've had the opportunity to know about is that I think the boards in general have a tough job and try hard to do it well. I think people have raised the question of whether or not it's appropriate to have the impaired practitioner programs integrated with the licensure board too. I certainly believe it's critical that there be communication, particularly when you have a recalcitrant person who is not serious about their rehabilitation, et cetera, that needs to be available to the licensing boards so they might take action. How best to set it up remains an open question in my own mind, and we will be looking, I'm sure, at other states as well in terms of how they handle this situation. Even in Oregon, it's handled differently among different boards. One example I can give you is between the Board of Nursing and the Board of Medical Examiners, which is not the Quincy people, but the people who license doctors. And that is, in the case of the Board of Nursing, decisions about who enters the nurse monitoring program, which is the impaired provider program, are generally made at the staff level and may or may not rise to the board. In the case of the Board of Medical Examiners, there is a subcommittee of the board that looks at these types of things and has a board member working with the staff on the decision of whether or not to enter an individual into an impaired practitioner program. That's just one example. I'm not saying which one is better or worse. There are 9,000 doctors. There are 60,000 nurses. And so the board member's ability to take part at that level for the nurses might not be as practical. But
I'm not sure that's the way the BME actually works.
I agree.
I mean, that isn't the structure of the BME, I think, monitoring program. I think there's a separate committee, not a subcommittee of the board.
I believe it's a subcommittee appointed by the board.
It's a committee appointed by the board.
Yes. But I mean, again, I think your question's well stated, and I think it is a policy issue about what in the 21st century do we think is the right way to go. And if it's not to have them joint, then what is the appropriate way to set that up? And what are the appropriate linkages that need to be put in place so that the system works to the benefit of the public?
Just one final thought. That is the systemic aspect of it. The nurses' board also has other problems that may be inherent with what's going on here. And I just want to remind you that 2 years ago when they came before our subcommittee on ways and means and misrepresented the truth about their financial affairs and failed to tell the committee that they had squirreled away several hundred thousand dollars of money from the prior budget without telling us that it wasn't, that it was going to be available and sent back to them by the DAS after the budget's passed and we ended our session. And when this all came out, it was certainly very embarrassing for them and was very disconcerting to the Ways and Means Committee to find that a board that was coming to us for their budget had failed to tell us that they hadn't spent all of their money, that they had sent it away and were going to get it back. And it was a sad situation that should never have happened. And I would hope that there's been changes in not only systemic way that functions, but also an attitude that would think that it's okay to not give full disclosure to a Ways and Means Committee. So they're a little bit suspect, in my opinion.
Chair Greenlicker, Representative Richardson, that does precede my tenure here, but and I was unaware of that, so I appreciate you pointing it out. I think that we are trying to look at all aspects of this to make sure that, and actually one of the other questions we have is the board adequately staffed? Do they have enough workforce to do the tasks that they've been given to do as well? There are quite a number of cases, quite a caseload, significant caseloads that are going on there too, and so we will be looking at that as well.
Just on that point, there is something that could be considered for Oregon that takes place elsewhere, and that is the idea of having renewal licenses not necessarily have to be handled by each of the boards. I mean, if you're renewing and there's been no major change, you might free up resources in the Board of Nursing and the other boards by having a kind of a centralized renewal system where they've got computer terminals and they can bring up whether it's this board or this one. It'd be very efficient and it would lessen the resource requirements.
Yeah. One of the disconcerting pieces, and I you know, that kind of streamlining or consolidation is certainly available for our consideration. One of the distressing issues that came up in this specific case was the time lag in the LEDS, the law enforcement database, in terms of the lag time of data entry into that, so that when it was queried, certain things did not show up. And also, there are cases where some activity has occurred in that interim period. So, and then I would question also that you may also, I think there are questions about whether you look at things in isolation or whether you look at the larger picture to discern patterns. And I think that's an important aspect as they look at some of these things, too, is if you sit down and look at only the period of time between the last license and the current license, you may miss the fact that there's a significant pattern over the history of the licensee. So it's very challenging, and I appreciate your questions. I think they're spot on in terms of some of the questions we're asking ourselves.
And generally, what's the relationship between the governors, and what's the structural relationship between the governor's office and the board?
Yeah, it's a
and
it's
DHS
a,
and the board.
Yeah, it's a kind of interesting structure in that regard. The governor appoints the members of the board, and I believe the staff serve at the pleasure of the board. So we do not have direct supervisory control over the board staff. However, we've had no problems with getting their cooperation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Maurer?
So I guess that leads to exactly where I'm going is the so the oversight of the board really is the legislature. Would that be an accurate statement?
Well, I think the legislature has the opportunity to have oversight over everything. I mean, I don't think there's anything you can't have oversight over, quite frankly.
And quite frankly, I would disagree, because we've been cut out of a number of programs for confidential reasons. I'm not going to say that that's always it's always needed or necessary. But the point is that is there, I guess the next question is there a national oversight, i.e. hospitals are independent, but they've got JCO, Joint Commission for Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. Is there an oversight for the nursing board or for the BME?
There's not a JCO-like organization that I'm aware of for licensure boards. I believe there are associations of boards of licensing, but I don't believe you have a standard setting, JCO accreditation type of activity.
Well, it seems to me that in my very few contacts with the boards through this legislative session, is that there needs to be some oversight, some auditing capability that's independent of the boards, because we have boards that operate in silos that do not talk to each other, which is obvious through the due process piece of the licensees, which is a different issue. But the point is that I don't feel like we have oversight. In an issue like this, you look at it from two points. You look at it from the incident, very specific incident, and does that show you a systemic problem? And then you look at the overall program and say, how does this organization function? And without outside eyes, it is extremely difficult to, you start to blind yourself because you're so close to the problem.
And I think one of the things in the case of the Board of Nursing over the last several years, there have been a number of reports and sets of recommendations that have been made. One is an external audit. One, I think Pete Shepard may talk to you some about. Another is an internal reflection that the board did themselves, a task force. And they also have a spreadsheet of all those recommendations and the status of their implementation. Interestingly enough, one of my observations is some of the not yet implemented pieces are pertinent to the specific case that generated this interest and so forth too, I would just say that that has helped us understand this a little bit better.
They are basically semi-autonomous boards. Is that the
yes?
The boards are appointed by the governor, and these are citizens of the state, and so you certainly don't want to disparage their effort and the work that they do.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes the boards meet four times a year or something, so it isn't really the board.
It's right.
So much as the staff.
But if you look at nonprofit hospitals, you have a governing board which does not run day-to-day operations. You have a staff, but clearly there's oversight, and you don't necessarily expect the board. In fact, you don't want the board to be in their hip pocket day-to-day, because that would be that's inappropriate. But.
And I think I think these questions, again, are all spot on in terms of the right questions to be asking. And I think Representative Greenlick's leadership in terms of moving this into the interim and taking a harder look at it is really, as I said, extremely timely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for your help.
It's up to you.
I'd like DHS next. Do we have a couple of folks we want to bring?
Mary Gear and Bill Buckley. From
Mary Gear and Bill. And
I think Mr. Buckley.
Bill Buckley. We talk about. Thank you all for coming. I think we'd like to hear, whatever you have to say, but we'd like to hear a little bit about the overall relationship between DHS and the nursing board and the institutions, and then particularly the criminal background piece of it. would be useless. Ms. Kerr, will you start?
Sure. Sure. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Mary Geer. I'm the administrator of the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care for the Department of Human Services. My office is responsible for licensing and regulating long-term care facilities in Oregon. That would mean nursing facilities, community-based care facilities like assisted living and residential care facilities. We also oversee foster homes, and we do complaint investigations in all of those settings, either through our survey process or through adult protective services. So we have working relationship with the Board of Nursing in a couple of different areas. Our usual process in investigating a complaint, an allegation of abuse, and complaints can come from a number of sources: the public, family members, residents, and the facilities themselves are required to self-report incidences of abuse or alleged abuse. We would go in and investigate that particular incident that happened. And if there is a finding that abuse occurred, then we make a determination about the culpability of the facility. And in particular situations of a nursing facility, we also look at culpability of the individual staff that might have been involved. So in the recent case, that was a nursing facility, and investigating that particular incident, we would look at both of those things. If the facility is found to have been out of compliance with state or federal regulations, we would then take enforcement action against the facility. And that could be in the form of a ban on their future admissions until they come into compliance. It might be in the form of a fine, a civil penalty fine. It may be in the form of some technical assistance or consultative services to them. If we find that a particular staff individual or individuals were implicated in the abuse incident, there are different things that we do depending on the status of that particular employee. In the case of a competency-evaluated nurse aide, the frontline staff in facilities, or the direct caregivers, nurse aides are certified, and there is a registry on which they're kept. And so we have federal funds that we receive from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to keep a registry of our nurse aides and to flag any nurse aides who have substantiated abuse against them. And, in fact, we at DHS contract with the Board of Nursing to create and maintain that registry for us. So when we have a nurse aide who's got substantiated abuse, we make the referral to the Board of Nursing, and they flag that nurse aide's certification so that aide, any future employment that aide may seek, that employer can look and see that there's been substantiated abuse in the history. In the case of a licensed practitioner like a nurse,
an LPN,
an RN, and potentially other health professionals who might be licensed, we would make a referral directly to the licensing board that oversees. So in this particular case, if this individual had been substantiated for abuse in the past, we would have made a referral to the Board of Nursing to have that addressed through whatever licensure action that they may take with that professional. So that's how we would deal with the facility and with any particular individual. And
you follow up with the board when you when you provide information to them as to what their action is on it?
Chair Greenlick, we make a referral or share information with the Board of Nursing in writing, and it's standard practice for us to ask for follow-up information in that initial referral. There are times when the Board of Nursing is not able to share information with us because of actions that they may take and their requirements for confidentiality around licensure issues. We may get follow-up information, we may not, depending on the particular situation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Geer, you said that when you receive the complaint, then you do the referral to the relevant licensing board. Can you talk about how you receive the complaint and where the different sources of complaints? Is it a phone call? Is it something in writing? Is it and what's the is there some sort of threshold requirement that you have before you make the referral?
Chair Greenlee and Representative Bonamici, we receive allegations of all kinds of incidents, including abuse and neglect, through a number of different sources. We have a hotline. Our local offices in the counties may receive a phone call. We can receive information by fax. Facilities often will self-report what's happened through our fax system. So we gather information in as many ways as we can to make it as easy as possible for incidents that need to be investigated to get to us for investigation. And then we have a triage process that we use to look at the particular allegation. Does it fall within our jurisdiction? Where does it best belong? What's the best professional to look at that? It may be that we have nurse investigators that may be most appropriate to look at a particular situation as opposed to a social worker or some other professional. And so that's how the investigation would begin. Throughout an investigation, there are a number of different outcomes that could occur. One could be that it's not substantiated. We just don't have any evidence that there was any culpability at all in what may have happened. And in that case, there would be no referral to the Board of Nursing. The only time we would refer would be when we had substantiated abuse that we were that we found that licensed nurse or that registered nurse to be in part responsible for. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Aguirre, you indicated that your department deals with licensing and complaint investigation. And so do you deal with licensing, providing licenses for those nurses who apply to become licensed?
Chair Greenlee and Representative Flores, we license facilities. We don't license individuals.
Thank you. Okay, then I guess my question in regard to the person in this instance having received a license and a criminal background check that showed conviction for past drug abuses and so on would go to someone else.
Yes.
Although perhaps there is a nexus as to the facility having hired someone that has had that background, and that's the nexus of the problem, I guess, is that she was hired and employed at facilities that you do also license.
Mr. Buckley, you can jump in anytime.
Chair Greenlee and Representative Flores, sorry, Bill, if I may, just a moment. You heard Ms. Saylors testify that this was really a connection of a couple of different things. And this particular facility, the Pearl, is one where we have had a number of complaints on a variety of issues since they opened in December of 2005. And when we went back and looked at this particular facility, we've got two incidences of substantiated times when this facility failed to follow state law regarding criminal history checks in particular in the last 6 months. And so part of our responsibility then as regulators is to look at this particular facility, and in fact it's broadened to this particular corporation that owns a number of facilities in Oregon and what their practices are around this, and we've identified this as a systemic issue. And so we will be following up on the regulatory and licensure side for the facility to ensure that that's being addressed appropriately.
You have the power to suspend their licenses?
Chair Greenlee, yes, we do have the power to suspend or revoke facility licenses. Having said that, I will also say that when we suspend or revoke a license, what that means is that the residents in those facilities have to be relocated. And so that's something that, you know, Ms. Saylors talked about balance and this committee talked about balance. That's one of the balances that we have, is balancing resident safety with the disruption that's caused from relocating frail and elderly citizens to different settings.
That is assuming that there's only two options, in business, when you have a corporation that is gets crosswise, sometimes there will be a trustee ordered to intervene. And I mean, there are other options that this body could consider that would not necessarily tell everybody just to move out because you're taking a license away from the current management. And so that would be one thing I would hope you'd look at. And but I have a couple questions. One is, when is the last time that you did suspend a license, or has there ever been time when a facility's license was suspended because of their bad acts?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Richardson, the last time that we took regulatory action against a facility was in February of this year, and that was a residential care facility. And we actually revoked the license and relocated the residents from that facility because of a long history of noncompliance in that particular facility. So it's not unheard of that we would take that action. And you are absolutely correct. There are a number of things that we can do in the interim. You know, that could include a trustee, a consultant. It could mandate and require some education in this particular situation for this corporation. I'm working with Mr. Buckley in his office to make sure that this corporation understands their legal requirements for criminal history checks. And then if they fail to follow that, then we would take progressive steps up to and including license revocation if that's indicated.
Okay, may I ask a question, Mr. Buckley? In the most recent article in the Tribune, it talks about kind of a difference of opinion between you and Mr. Schneider as to whether or not the DHS notified them that this individual would be unacceptable. And I think your comment, according to the paper, was that you had notified them that she was not approved to be hired, but they'd gone ahead and hired anyway, and now they're denying that. What happens?
Let's have Mr. Buckley talk about the whole process.
Okay.
How you deal with them, and then we are interested in this.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Buckley. I'm the Criminal Records Unit Manager for the Department of Criminal Services. The Criminal Records Unit was formed in 2001, and it was established as one centralized unit to perform the background screening processes for DHS. Prior to that, each one of the major program offices, seniors, mental health, developmental disabilities, child care, child welfare, had their own separate and distinct criminal background check process. So we became a single unit back in the year 2001. Today, the Criminal Records Unit processes in excess of 16,000 background checks in any given month. By far the majority of those background check processes are done through providers of services such as the Avamere group that is in the limelight today. Once we receive an application, a request for criminal history background check, our unit will start the background check process. And what we do is we initially take the application, look the application over, go into the law enforcement data system to run a name and date of birth check for criminal histories through that system. We will also use the Oregon Judicial Information Network, DMV records, and other court and regional records to make a fitness determination on the subject individual. Oftentimes, a provider is considered a qualified entity. In this case, Avamere is a qualified entity. That qualified entity assigns or appoints an authorized designee to actually conduct the fitness determination for their organization. Avamere has such authorized designees within their organization. We gather the information, send it to the authorized designee for the fitness determination. In this particular case, the individual had listed as the residency address a Washington State residency address. Because it was an out-of-state residency address, we will require fingerprints of the individual to perform a nationwide check. When we perform the nationwide check on that individual, the CRU, the Criminal Records Unit, then will make the fitness determination on the individual because we cannot share that FBI information out with the agencies. In November of 06, we made the fitness determination on the subject individual. That fitness determination was a denial of fitness for employment to that organization. We documented the fact that we performed the denial. Our procedure calls for us to mail that denial to the individual concerned as well as to the facility, and then follow up with a phone call to the facility if the individual was placed on probationary status, as this individual was. The probationary status was granted initially by the facility after performing a preliminary fitness determination, taking into account the individual's disclosure of criminal information and their response to that criminal information. That was performed by the authorized designee at Avamere. Avamere alleges never to have received the notice of fitness determination and therefore kept the individual in a probationary status up to this incident time. Part of our requirements for an authorized designee is to ensure that a timely background check process is performed. If they did not hear from us within a 21-day time frame after the fingerprints were requested, they should have contacted our organization to find out what the results of that fingerprint determination was. That never took place, nor was it ever recorded. So up until the time that the incident was reported in the Portland Tribune, we were under the assumption that the individual was not working at that facility.
Did you also notify the board?
The board was, to tell you the truth, I truly don't know if the board was contacted or not. I know that the Board of Nursing was contacted on the license of the individual, that once we received the information from the Portland Tribune, that we researched the criminal history one more time and found a recent arrest for possession of narcotics. And we relayed that information to the board at that time, that there was a recent arrest on that criminal history. That would be our policy and procedure to do so.
Dennis, you had a question?
No.
Still there?
No.
Another question? And your basic process generally does include notifying the board when you find a criminal
activity? Chair Grievance, that is correct. If we are performing a background check on an individual who is licensed by the board and we see recent criminal history, we would notify the board either through their investigator or another individual that a recent criminal history was detected on an individual. We cannot share that LEDS information with the Board of Nursing because of the state police rules on sharing information that was obtained through name, date of birth searches, because there is no positive connection between the individual and the criminal history without the fingerprints. So what we would do is basically notify them that there was recent criminal history. You might want to look into it.
Question?
Well, is there a similar process for hospitals? For RN licensing checks for hospitals?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm not sure as far as hospitals are concerned. I do know that the Board of Nursing for licensure will conduct their own criminal history background check process as well as for renewal. Our process is separate and distinct from that since we're talking about employment to a facility that provides care.
Follow-up question on what you said as far as the notification of the board about these findings, even if it's general, if you say you need to take a look at it, do you know, as you've looked at your records, whether or not there specifically was notification done on Mrs. Bork's to the Board of Nursing.
Chair Greenlet, Representative Richardson, when I look at the summary of events that took place, I do not see that recorded on our summary. Since this incident, we have met and we have restructured our summary sheet to make sure that all phone calls are included on that summary sheet, as well as making sure that those entities that need to be called or connected with the incident are indeed called. And what we've done is create a summary sheet as well as the supporting documentation to be filed with that individual's criminal history report.
So in all fairness to the Board of Nursing, it's possible they didn't even know about the criminal background of this nurse?
Chair Greenlet, Representative Richardson, the Board of Nursing, I believe, was aware of the criminal history of the subject individual. I don't think they were aware of the most recent criminal activity, the arrest that took place in, and I believe it was April of this year. They were aware of the convictions in 2005 because the individual had come up for license renewal, and if I'm not mistaken, they would perform a background check process at that time and would note that the criminal activity was on that record.
Thank you both very much.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, Senator Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Buckley, as you were kind of outlining your process, you review an applicant's application, you use the LEDS process, DMV records, Oregon Judicial System documents, other records and documents that might be available to determine for their fitness determination. And you indicated you use name and date of birth information, but if there is an out-of-state address, that triggers a nationwide FBI check?
Chair Greenlet, Representative Flores, that is correct. There are a couple instances where a national check would be required. One would be on the application that the individual actually divulged out-of-state criminal history. Residency requirements, most of our background check processes require an individual to report any out-of-state residency within the last 3 or 5 years, depending upon the program. If we see that, then we're going to require a fingerprint-driven national check. If there are any issues with identity, for instance, in a name, date of birth check, we might pick up 3 Jane Does with similar dates of birth and maybe social security numbers. Then we would require a nationwide check so that we make positive identification on that individual. Those are some of the reasons why we would run that check.
Well, you just mentioned a piece that I wasn't hearing before, that social security piece. So when you originally begin your review process, name, date of birth, and are you also then using that social security identifier?
Correct. We are, if given. Social security numbers are voluntary. As far as reporting that on the criminal history request form.
Mm. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's take a slight detour and let's ask Mr. Shepherd to join us to talk about the role of DOJ and the whole process. I'd particularly ask Mr. Shepherd to talk specifically about the question of what the Medicaid Fraud Unit does in the Attorney General's office and how it relates to this situation, and the general question of the function of the Attorney General's office relative to the boards.
Mr. Chair, members
thank,
of the...
Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General, and your staff is handing to you a document that is entitled the four functions relevant to the committee's announced topic. So I hope to touch on those very briefly for your benefit. The first institutional function that we perform in relation to the boards that license medical professionals as well as to all other boards is that we serve as general counsel in the effort to help ensure that each of the boards conform their conduct to the requirements of law, and that those could be federal laws, state laws, all other forms of legal obligations or the kinds of things that our general counsel division would be advising agencies and boards about. Each of the boards is assigned a contact attorney, and so you probably have encountered in the course of your work here in this building various occasions when agencies have, in order to respond to a request for information from you, have wanted to bring their lawyer. That what they're referring to is a contact lawyer in the department who's been assigned by the Attorney General to help that agency understand what its obligations under law may be. The second institutional function that the board performs is the one that relates specifically to the area that the chair referred to, and rather includes the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. And that is that the Attorney General is authorized by law to share responsibility for some criminal law investigations and some criminal prosecutions with district attorneys, who in Oregon are the primary local prosecutors at any rate of crimes that occur in Oregon. We perform those functions actually through two units, either of which could be involved in a matter that involved a medical licensee. One of those is the one that the chair has referred to, and that's the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. And in general, that unit has responsibilities and that are predominantly funded by federal grants to deal with two broad classes of cases. The first class of case would be instances in which a healthcare provider is providing a form of service that is in some way funded in whole or in part by Medicaid funds. And that's the first classification of cases in which our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, as to which our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit could expend the federal monies that we receive as federal grants. And secondly, the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit is also authorized by federal law to use the federal funds to investigate and prosecute cases involving abuse or neglect of residents of any type of long-term care facility, regardless of the facility status with respect to Medicaid or the patient status with respect to being benefited by Medicaid funds. So those are the two categories generally of offenses that our Medicaid Fraud Unit can deal with. And our Criminal Justice Division, as I noted in the materials, has a broad criminal investigative authority that could be triggered in any of the kinds of cases that our Medicaid Fraud Unit also might have authority to investigate. The third institutional function that the Attorney General's Office performs that may be relevant in your considerations of the broad topic you're addressing is that we have a consumer protection investigation and prosecution function. And we carry that out predominantly through two state statutes, either one of which or both potentially could be implicated in the evaluation of misconduct by a medical licensee. The first is the State Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and the second is the Elder or Person with Disabilities Abuse Act. And both of those give the Attorney General authority under civil statutes to both investigate and prosecute civilly, that is, to injunctions or other forms of civil relief, violations of those statutes. And again, those violations conceivably could be committed by the licensee of a regulatory board. And finally, the area where I'd end and leave open for questions is that the Attorney General actually has a statutory charge to be a policy advisor to the Legislative Assembly, the Executive Branch, and through them to the public, and that charge is in ORS 185201E. And just by way of closing, there are two examples of that that brings us full circle to the Board of Nursing in particular. The first is the work that you did and on Senate Bill 433, which has now become an enrolled bill by virtue of your action. And that measure is attached to the materials I've distributed, and what it does is change the statute that controls the gateway into the Board of Nursing's nurse monitoring program so as to enlarge the authority of the board to exclude persons from that program by expanding it from the former law, which simply permitted by as a matter of statute at any rate, exclusion if the person, if the board was unable to make the finding that there is no danger to the public health if the person seeking admission to the nurse monitoring program were to be admitted. And the statute enlarges that, the authority of the board to exclude persons from that program to include the public health, safety, or welfare, a broader standard, a more protective standard, if you will, for the public. And then the second area in this session, which the Attorney General carried out his institutional responsibility to be a policy advisor, has to do with the budget of the Board of Nursing. And one of the things that we learned and concluded in earlier examinations of the Board of Nursing, and specifically as to its interrelationship with law enforcement, criminal law enforcement agencies, is that the board seemed at least to be lacking in the capacity to adequately investigate and to coordinate the investigations that they do of regulated persons, licensees. And so the Attorney General joined the Governor in supporting the Board's request for additional resources, which I understand the Assembly has done this session, to provide additional investigative resources to help it discharge its responsibilities.
Mr. Shepard, what role would your agency have in regard to investigating a complaint of criminal misdoing, criminal problems inside a licensing board?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the statute, the Legislative Assembly has made, and I think it was may have been 1980, I'm not sure of the exact date, has actually charged the Attorney General specifically with conducting investigations of what's described in Chapter 180 as public corruption offenses. And we've taken over the years a broad view of what public corruption means, and it extends. There is no crime called public corruption. There are an assortment of crimes that can be committed by public officials or public servants. And so we have long had the responsibility of conducting criminal investigations of public servants who are alleged to have committed any crime. And so we have on many occasions conducted such investigations and on many occasions prosecuted such cases.
In this case, if you were conducting an investigation of, let's say, the nursing board or the board of licensed massage therapist or whatever it is, their attorney protecting them in that investigation would be from your same firm, is that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a really good question, because I think it illustrates a fundamental, you have to be really careful about the language we use. The Attorney General...
I get that language from listening to the Attorney General's campaign talk, where he said what we were doing as a state was hiring our attorney on his behalf. So I assume, therefore, your organization is like a law firm, right?
Mr. Chair, that's quite correct.
Okay.
But the key question is, who is our client? And when I say we have to be careful about our language, I don't mean that as an admonition to the committee only. I mean it as self-directed to our agency and to the agencies that we advise. Because in common parlance, it is very common for an agency to say, we have our attorney here. This is Mr. Shepard. He's our attorney. As though the attorney had an individualized attorney-client relationship with that agency. But that's not the case. the Legislative Assembly has made the choice rather that the Attorney General has a single client. If you will, the Attorney General is the lawyer for General Motors Corporation, not the lawyer for the Parts Department, or the lawyer for the Assembly Line Department, or the lawyer for the Transportation Sub-Department of General Motors. Our attorney-client relationship runs to the people of the state of Oregon, the state of Oregon, not to any individual entity.
But you wouldn't claim attorney-client privilege in your discussions between you and the director of the board?
No, we would not. No, I'm sorry. We would claim attorney-client privilege as to a party external to the government, yes, because our client is the state of Oregon, and the director of the Board of Nursing, the executive director of the Board of Nursing, is an employee of our client.
Now, wait a second. I thought you said you're representing the people. So the people asked you, how can you have it both ways?
Well, Mr. Chair, the client we have is the state of Oregon. Ultimately, the Attorney General is accountable to the people, of course, but the client, I violated my own rule by being insufficiently precise. The Attorney General's singular client is the state of Oregon. And as a consequence of that, when we represent the state, we have an attorney-client relationship with the state, just as we do, as any lawyer would, in private practice. And so as to any inquiry external to that relationship, we not only have the authority to assert the privilege, but we do assert it, because that's how we serve the public interest. Now,
as it sounded like English words. Yeah. The problem is when they got in the sentence, it got a little bit of a problem.
If you were representing General Motors, to say that you're not representing the part department may sound good only until some other attorney wanted to talk to a member of the parts department, at which time, because of the rules of employer-employee relationship, they wouldn't be able to talk to them in litigation unless the attorney for management was there. But as a law firm, if you represented General Motors and you also represented the investigatory agency, say, the National Traffic Investigation Board that investigates General Motors, do you think that you might have difficulty with the Bar Association if you had both of those clients in the same firm?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we would, but that's not the situation we have.
How is that not the situation we have when you've shown us that you help agencies conform to the conduct of law? We can't talk. I mean, you represent the agencies at hearings. We've gone over this recently with DHS and who's going to represent the caseworkers. Well, it wasn't outside people. It was DHS attorneys. And that's just a little agency, you know, part of another agency.
DOJ attorneys, not DHS attorneys.
Right? Well, DOJ attorneys
DOJ
represent.
No, that's the important point.
Yeah, DHS.
Attorneys assigned by the Attorney General would provide counsel to those state agencies. That's correct.
And yet, if there are complaints against those agents, the acts that are taking place, those complaints go to your department. I guess maybe another way to ask this is, how often do you actually lead out in doing internal investigations? I mean, do you have a process, you know, kind of like auditors would audit, and does DOJ have a process where they don't wait for complaints, but they're actually out there making sure that the laws are being complied with?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, if you're asking about do we have a process to kind of proactively go out and detect criminal misconduct, if that's the focus of your question, then the answer is no. That we are complaint-driven in terms of we don't initiate an investigation until we have some cause to think that a crime...
I complain to you that there's criminal activity going on in the behavior of people in the Board of Naturopathic Physicians, and you say it would be your responsibility to investigate that.
We could be... We would have authority to do that, yes.
And your responsibility to be the counsel for the exec of that board, for whom the claim is being made against.
Mr. Chair, no, that's not quite right. We are the lawyer for the state, which means that we would not. For example, let's suppose that a public servant and I prosecuted some of these cases. I'll take a historical case. Suppose that, and we don't have to suppose it, an investment officer in the past employed by the Oregon State Treasury was suspected of trading in, using his authority as a state official to trade for his personal benefit. So the allegation came to the Attorney General. The Attorney General was asked to conduct a criminal investigation of that matter. The Attorney General would not provide counsel to that individual because we can't represent, we don't represent the individual. We represent the state of Oregon. What is the state of Oregon's interest in the face of those allegations? It's in running to ground the criminal allegations and prosecuting the individual, even though he may be an employee of the state. That is not a situation in which there's a conflict of interest. So we conducted the investigation, prosecuted the individual, and there was no question. He had to retain his own lawyer if he wished to assert a privilege or otherwise to deal with the investigators. That would not be a matter that the state, the Attorney General, could represent him on.
So if I asserted that there is some activity going on in Board X, inside the board, inside the employees of the board would not be able to use, the employees of the board would not be able to use a DOJ attorney to advise them about how to react to the investigation charging activity inside the board.
That's correct. We would not have an attorney-client relationship as to such a charge.
Representative Bonamici?
Thank you.
We have two lawyers here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I think Mr. Shepard may have answered my question, because I was going to go back to the example that Representative Richardson used earlier about the prior session where the nursing board apparently, or should I say allegedly, sent some money away during the session and then had it brought back. And I'm assuming from Representative Richardson's description that there was some sort of impropriety there. Would you investigate that? And if so, would you represent the nursing board, and the individual board members would then have to go get separate counsel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, if there were an allegation of a crime that was committed by an agency of the board, an agent of the board, then it would be within the Attorney General's statutory charge to investigate that as a potential crime. We would not represent anyone as to a potential crime. We could not advise anyone as to their individual response to a potential crime.
You know what? For clarification, what took place was the Board of Nursing sent back to DAS, I think it was $350,000, and so it was off their books when they came, and this was money that they didn't spend on remodeling. And then they came to our subcommittee saying, we need money for remodeling, more money. But they forgot to mention that they hadn't even spent what they already had in the current budget. And when it finally came out, and it didn't come out until two representing myself went to their offices in Portland and looked around, and things weren't like we'd expected, asked more questions, asked to see the lease, then it was disclosed because it was going to show up. Then what we were told is that we weren't doing anything that other agencies don't do. That gives you some confidence, because the idea was that we passed the budget based on what we were being told, and then the new biennium comes, and then DAS transfers back the money that was kind of off budget. And so it gets added on to what they get for the next biennium, and it just gets stacked on, and this legislative body is none the wiser because it's all buried in the budget. Anyway, that wasn't very
deep enough.
Well, it wasn't happily received by our committee, and LFO fully substantiate that that's what happened. So it was, but there was not, and nobody was saying that it was embezzlement or criminal or anything like that. It was just a device to withhold information from the Ways and Means process for an agency that's seeking more funding.
I suspect before we're done, we're going to hear allegations of, if not criminal activities, serious improprieties on behalf of members of boards. I'm just going to be interested when I find one of the DOJ attorneys here who tells me, well, but that's attorney-client privilege. We can't talk about that. And when that happens, we can rediscuss the issue of where that will come up.
Mr. Chair, I'd be remiss if I didn't convey to you the Attorney General's view that the subject that you have on which you've embarked here is a very meritorious one, the subject of examining how we can better protect the public through this regulatory mechanism. And the Attorney General asked me to convey his commitment that we'd be happy to help with that process during the interim.
Would that include showing us the spreadsheet of recommendations that was mentioned earlier?
Surely. As a matter of fact, I don't know whether the board, they may intend to provide that with you. And Representative Richardson, we did, in the course of earlier work that we did last fall with the board, we did produce a report that examined, as I mentioned, the little narrow piece of the issue involving the interface between the Board of Nursing and law enforcement. And we made a series of recommendations that, and I'd be happy to send that to you as well.
Send it to our administrator. Would be
very well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shepard. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
I think this would be time, nice time to talk to Ms. Bouchard, the executive of the Board of Nursing. You should go the other way. Thank you very much for coming in. As I told you on the phone yesterday, we had a phone conversation, and I really want to make sure we're not here in the sense of a witch hunt. I really hope that you would help us use the allegations in the current situation to talk about how you balance protecting the public and protecting the profession, both important and legitimate processes, and then maybe comment a bit on, as we talked about, on the monitoring program.
Right. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, I'm Joan Bouchard, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon State Board of Nursing. And just to put the board a little bit in perspective, we regulate nursing practice in the state, and we regulate 63,000 individuals and about 67,000 licensees. And those licensees include registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, nursing assistants, certified medication aides, nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, nurse anesthetists, and clinical nurse specialists. So we also, in terms of the number of investigations we do a year, we do approximately 2,200 investigations as a result of criminal records checks, and about 700 plus investigations regarding complaints of nursing practice. Most of those complaints come in from employers. Some come in from self-disclosure on applications. About 10% of them come from families, and 8% come from other nurses and coworkers. And about 2% come from law enforcement. The types of complaints we get are mostly on substance abuse, abuse and neglect, and failure to perform duties, medication administration, and arrests and convictions. We also have a nurse monitoring program, which has been discussed earlier, and we have about 300 participants in our nurse monitoring program. We currently have a staff of about 44, and in the investigations department, we have one manager and 10 investigators, two administrative staff. And in the nurse monitoring program, we have two case managers and one administrative person. And as Mr. Shepard referred to, we were able to receive three new positions this legislative session. We'll have one additional nurse manager, or nurse monitoring program case manager, a new lead investigator, and another administrative assistant to help us with this load. During the past year, the board has taken a multifaceted approach to evaluating both its disciplinary program and its nurse monitoring program. Starting in fall of 2005, the board did an internal review of the nurse monitoring program. This is a program that's been around since 1991, and it has been reviewed twice since then, but the board felt that it was time to do another evaluation of the nurse monitoring program. Also, as a result of the series of articles of the Portland Tribune, the board decided that they would do an external audit. of the program, both the nurse monitoring program and of the disciplinary program. That was done last summer and reported to the board and to the Senate Health Policy Committee twice last year, last fall. We also, as you heard Mr. Shepherd say, we did joint work with the Department of Justice, and we disseminated a joint report to the board and also reported that to the Senate Interim Committee, both in March of 2006 and also in October of 2006. And finally, we also established a task force last year to look at the nurse monitoring program, to look at our current rules and regulations that regarding the nurse monitoring program, the criteria to get in the nurse monitoring program, criteria for staying in the nursing monitoring program, and all the public policy issues that the nursing monitoring program address, not just with nurses, but with anybody that has a substance abuse program for health professionals. We took that task force was made up by a very wide representation of people, including treatment providers, nurses, employers of nurses, and consumers. And we're taking the recommendations that came from that task force and using that as the basis for looking at revising the rules and rulemaking that will happen this fall. So where are we now regarding all the audits and the evaluations that we've done in the last year? We are now we are implementing the recommendations and, as I said, taking the policy issues from the Nurse Monitoring Task Force and implementing them. I quickly want to just address Representative Maurer's questions about oversight of the boards of nursing. We are an other funded agency, so we get no general funds, but we fall under all the state rules and regulations in terms of personnel, contracting, auditing, accounting, and every we also fall under the Secretary of State's office in terms of auditing. So they come in and audit us periodically as well. And then lastly, you've also heard from the Governor's office that there currently is also a review that is being done by the Governor's office for the Board of Nursing. So we feel that we have both within ourselves really looked and evaluated our programs and also have had a lot of external audits in the last year regarding that. Specifically, I know that you're interested in the case that was cited in the Portland Tribune last week. And because of our confidentiality laws, I'm not allowed to talk about the investigative part of it, but I am allowed to talk about the licensing part and how did this come around in this specific situation. And I think, you know, what this case shows that there's a number of safeguards that are set up by a number of agencies. And most of the time they work very well, but in this is a case that demonstrates when some things can go wrong within the system, and I think that it's a good example of how we all need to look at our systems and the roles that we play. The different roles in this case, you could see, were, number one, the Board of Nursing and what our responsibilities are about the individual licensees. There's the DHS's role regarding the facilities. We also have employer responsibilities around these issues and their responsibilities and requirements for hiring employees. And also, in this case, we had the state police and their role in the law enforcement database system. And then, of course, we have the nurse and what her professional conduct was. From our point of view, this is how this incident happened that was reported in the Tribune last week. First of all, you heard Department of Human Services and SPD talk about the employer and the responsibility there. The employer usually does a criminal records check. In this case, the employer did not do their own criminal records check, and either they did not receive or they did not abide by SPD's directive of a no hire, and so this nurse was hired in November of 06. In terms of our role in it, this nurse, I'm just going to give you a timeline here. On March 28th of 07, this nurse was arrested for possession of meth at 7 p.m. and she was released by police at approximately 7:58 p.m. on March 28th. She was due for renewal, so at 11:28 p.m., and we know this exactly because we do our renewals by e-commerce, and she went onto the computer at 11:28 that very same day to renew her license. And on the license application, it asked the nurse, have you been arrested, convicted of any crime in the last 2 years? And this nurse answered no to that question on our application 3 hours after she had been arrested. So the board the next day receives the application, and we begin processing it. We try very hard to process applications as quickly as we can because of the nursing shortage and because the employers are very anxious to get nurses on the job.
At that time, you had no prior information?
We had no information of this recent arrest.
No, but of any other arrests?
Yes, we did know of prior arrests, and we had investigated those issues and felt that she was not in a danger to the public at that time. We did not know about the prior arrest, the most current arrest that happened on March 28th. So we began processing our applications, and one of the steps that we do when we process a renewal application, we make sure that she meets all the requirements for renewal, and we also do a LEDS check, a law enforcement database check, on every application. So we went online on May 30th. So she renewed her application online on March 28th. On March 30th, we did a LEDS check on her. And at that time, the LEDS did not show the most recent arrest.
It showed other arrests.
It showed the other arrest, not the recent arrest. And we already knew about the other arrests. So on April 4th, the license was renewed, and she was issued a license. On March 1st, the Washington County DA office informed the Board of Nursing of the March 28th possession arrest.
March
28th was when she was arrested.
March 1st, you said?
March 28th.
On May 1st, we received
the Washington County information about the 328 arrest. And when we got that, our investigation began. We started subpoenaing records, etc. On May 29th is when we received the complaint from the daughter regarding the verbal abuse of the mother while at the facility. And this complaint was assigned to an investigator as well. And it was the same investigator. Then we investigated the case on June 09 of 07. The board did an emergency suspension of her license.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, first thing, my question was not about, my series of questions was not about state oversight from DOJ or state auditor. I was thinking from an outside agency that does boards, i.e. JCOs for hospitals. Is there a national board certification? Is there an association of state boards of nursing to kind of do this auditing? That was my question. And then, but then the other issue is, why would you not emergently suspend a license when you have when you know someone lied on their application about a recent arrest?
We didn't realize that she lied and that a recent arrest until we received that information on May 1st. That's when we realized that she lied.
And when was the complaint lodged by the daughter?
May 29th.
Again, my question is, why didn't she, when you found out May 1st that she lied on her application, to me, that would raise a serious red flag that you don't you don't conduct your investigation and then emergently suspend somebody. You emergently suspend somebody, then you conduct an investigation. At least that's how I think. It's emergency is emergency.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, under the APA, there are certain criteria that we have to meet in order to do an emergency suspension.
Under the APA, which is?
Administrative Procedures Act.
Thank you.
And I'm sure that either Pete, Mr. Shepherd, or Warren Foote from the AG's office would be glad to come up here and tell you what that standard is. But it's a certain standard that we have to meet in order to do an emergency suspension. And lying on the application
okay.
would
I'm
not...
I'm sorry.
Mr. Shepherd fled, so...
Okay, I'm...
Mr. Foote would be glad to do that.
We've had the discussion in committee about emergency suspensions of license. And we were assured by the boards that they have this broad sweeping authority to emergently suspend licenses because we were talking about administrative procedures for people that, you know, may have been, it's not, quote, emergency. And when someone lies about an arrest record, I mean, when you can make that nexus like this, right, they're right there. I mean, I don't know. I guess that, to me, raises to the level of time out. You're not practicing or you're not going to work until we can straighten this out.
Chair Greenlee, can we ask Mr. Foote to come and address the standard for emergency suspension for boards? And
sure, he's your lawyer. I think...
Depends.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Warren Foote. I'm a member of the Department of Justice, an attorney for the state of Oregon. Yes. And Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, in response to your question, the legal standard, as was referenced by Ms. Bouchard, is if the agency finds a serious danger to the public health and the agency sets forth its reasons for making those findings, it can emergency suspend. So the fact that in the board's judgment, they have to assess, did a person lie on their application to the board? And then they have to ask the next question, does the fact that they've lied in their application constitute a serious danger to the public health and safety? So they would have to look at, you know, the context of the lie and the nature of it and draw that connection to serious public danger.
Does it say serious or does it just say public safety?
It says if the agency finds a serious danger to the public health and safety, and that's the reference I'm reading from is
okay.
183.430 subparagraph 2.
But here's a person who the board A knows has had previous criminal convictions, knows they had a recent criminal arrest for meth, knows they lied on the application. I mean, if that doesn't represent a serious danger to the public health, I mean, would you have to murder somebody before they find some serious? I mean, that's amazing.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair, in response to your question, the board exercises its discretion. I'm not here to defend the exercise of the board's discretion, but they have to apply that legal standard to make that determination.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Are you at liberty, either of you, to talk about what the, you said that this particular person had prior convictions. Are you at liberty to disclose what those are? And if not, can you talk about, in general, what would be the kind of prior conviction someone would have that would lead to a determination that that didn't matter, he or she could still work as a nurse?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, I'm trying to think as to what's a matter of public record on this because there are certain confidentiality laws that apply to the Board of Nursing.
Let me read you a statement from the Tribune. It says, more than 2 years ago, the Oregon Department of Health Services told the State Board of Nursing that Carrie Lynn Bork's criminal record made her unfit to nurse at a DHS regulated facility.
And Mr.
So
Chair,
that may be a public record.
Supplement further down in the couple paragraphs down, it said the State Board of Nursing remained intact and gave no hint of problems in spite of the history of drug arrests and convictions stretching back 5 years, and DHS finding her responsible for patient abuse at a previous nursing home.
And again, Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, I'm really, as attorney for the state of Oregon, I'm really not here to defend an individual decision made by the board. There was a record of conviction. I think it's a matter of public record that she had convictions for drug-related offenses related to the possession of drugs. And that's something that the board would have to exercise its discretion on as to what to do with that.
What was the date of the suspension?
June 9th, 2007.
Thank you. How do you develop the criteria for what a serious threat to public health is? I mean, I know you've got 67,000 licenses to deal with. It's obviously not an easy task. How does something come to the level of becoming a serious threat to public safety?
Chair Greenlee, one of the major things we look at is there harm to the public? Is there potential harm for the public? And if there's potential harm for the public, then the board would consider that very serious.
This person wants to work in a nursing home. The assumption is that they're alone at night with the key to the drug cabinet, and they've got convictions of drug use. I mean, it just seems almost obvious as a criterion that would not be a fit employment for somebody with convictions of drug use. You don't have to get into this case. I mean, I talk about it generally.
Well, if someone is aware of the that there is a drug problem with a nurse or a substance abuse problem with a nurse, that nurse may be able to go into the nurse monitoring program. If they go into the nurse monitoring program, there's certain safeguards that are set up. They're under contract about what they can do and what they cannot do. And that is stated in our administrative rules.
Could you tell us about that monitoring program? That'd be great.
Okay. But before I do that, one of the other things the board has to look at is the nexus between the act and the action that the board takes. And maybe, Warren, you want to say something about the nexus issue.
Mr. Chair, just that there needs to be a nexus between the criminal act and the act in the practice of nursing, so that a person may be arrested for criminal misconduct, but we've had the Dearborn case and a subsequent case to that where a licensing board was told that, no, you can't take an action against this person's license based on this criminal misconduct because we don't think there's a connection between that criminal act and, in that case, the practice of real estate, for instance, or the practice of nursing. So it depends. The board has got to ask not only is it a criminal act, but do we think there's a connection to the practice of nursing? So that's another factor that has to go in the board matrix as a make that discretionary call.
I had experience with a physician who tried to kill his wife, tried to shoot her, didn't quite succeed at that, and then eventually got a great surgeon. Eventually got his license back. I suppose that was part of the argument that anybody could decide to shoot their wife. That's not.
Representative Green, like, I'm not aware of the case. Certainly after a person has their license revoked, after a certain amount of time under statute, they can reapply.
Yeah. And that makes sense. You monitor about 350 out of 67,000 licensees.
Yeah, that's
tell us about how you... Briefly, I'm sorry, was there a question?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay, this is
I do want to get a couple of other witnesses on.
This is bothering me. So on May 1st, I'm sorry, that's right. on May 1st, did you know about the timing between the arrest and her applying for the license, that couple hour at that, or did that come later?
Well, they hadn't known that.
Well, I can understand, you know, that yes, there was an arrest, and yes, she reapplied for a license. But the, I mean, you made special point that there was just a couple hours difference. Did you know that on May 1st?
Chair Greenlee, I can't answer that question, but Kim Coburn, who is our program manager for that case, would be able to tell you exactly at what point in time did we know that. Do we know that on May 1st?
Please introduce yourself.
Yes. For the record, my name is Kim Coburn. I'm the program executive for compliance investigation for the Board of Nursing, and essentially my overall responsibility is to manage the investigations as well as the nurse monitoring program. So to the extent I can help answer process questions, I'd be very happy to do so. With respect to this case, the process we have for the license renewal is that it doesn't it'll get kicked back to my department for investigation if there's a positive LEDS or a yes answer to, in particular, that question that Joan mentioned earlier. In this instance, neither of those happened. The LEDS came up negative, and the person misrepresented, shall we say, on the application. So
LEDS came up negative for new arrests.
Arrests. For arrests we were not aware of.
We only did the LEDS for the last 2 years. Yeah. For a time period of the last 2 years.
So to get to your question, if I may, sir, we were not made aware of the fact that she had falsified that application until, actually, what we were first made aware of was the arrest was reported to us. And just simply that arrest was sufficient to open up an investigation because it raised questions as to, well, what's going on here? We need to understand this. At that point,
was May 1st?
That was May 1st. Okay. And at that point, as part of our standard process, we would go get her last renewal form and say, what did that show on it? And it's at that point that we realized that, yes, in fact, she had falsified the application, if I can say that. So definitively,
May.
That would have been still the early parts of May.
Okay.
I would say probably May 10th.
Okay.
Was when the connection of, you know, not only the arrest but also the falsification was put together. Because on the 10th, on the 1st, we were notified of the arrest.
Right. Did the little red flag go up? Say, ooh, this is an issue. I mean, I would assume that 99.9% of the people are honest and hardworking and don't lie on their application. At least I hope not. And that if when this does happen, does that raise your red flag or whatever word you want to, descriptor you want to use?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, it does raise flags, and that's why it becomes, we do open an investigation into it. We prioritize these investigations. We do have a very significant workload, which we have been coming to the legislature with and describing and hoping we have found good solutions to get it where it needs to be, because we're very aware that it is not where it needs to be. That being the case, the cases that get the highest, the brightest red flag are instances of actual practice misconduct, where we have a complaint that comes in and says not that there's a potential that someone may then go to work and cause harm, but in fact someone has gone to work and caused harm. Due to that prioritization, this case was given a level 4, 1 being the most of greatest concern, 9 being the least of concern. Not that it's not of a concern, but in terms of prioritization. There's a specific memo that we had that the board went through in trying to assess, help its staff figure out how to assess these cases and process them accordingly. For example, a number 1 case coming in is going to bump everything else behind it. That being said, because what we did not have was specific conduct at work during practice, it did not rise to a level 1. But it would be inaccurate to say it did not raise a flag.
Okay. So you have a leveling system?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we do.
I'll drop it at this point.
And if I, Chair, Greenlee, if I may add to that, one of the reasons why when we got the complaint, it goes to the same investigator to make sure that we are coordinated. Now we have this issue of allegations of practice misconduct, and we can add that to this prior, and we will then investigate those concurrently. And we make sure it goes to the same investigator so they don't, you know, get lost in understanding the full context of what we're trying to deal with. So, to finish that process out.
Mr. Flores.
Small one, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. And I guess I'm not quite ready to let it drop, and I just want to ask an administrative.
Well, I expect we're going to be back on this before.
Well, Mr. Done. Chair, what I'm gathering here is, because I know I have developed this to an art form, but this is causing some heads to spin around. And this particular issue of having received the report on May 1st was May 10th that you checked the actual reapplication mm-hmm. for this person who is found to have made an untruthful assertion. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, you know, where are these records kept that it took 9 days to make that check and then another number of a month to make the determination from the date you retrieved it on May 9th to say, well, we better do something about this. Well, shouldn't it be a phone call? We've got a level 4 here and maybe we better do something about this. It's just interesting administrative lack of deftness, I guess.
Okay. If I may respond to that, Mr. Chairman and Representative Flores, you're hitting upon a very precise point that is what we keep trying to resolve, which is the time it takes to resolve matters. We are very aware that it takes longer than it should. That's why we have the prioritization. That's why we try and focus our resources as best we can. We ourselves house the renewal records. A standard process that we do when we get notice of a complaint, which is how we would perceive this notice to us coming that there had been this arrest, we would categorize that that's information coming to us from the outside complaint. It gets assigned to an investigator, and then a couple of things immediately happen. One is we run a new LEDS. On it doesn't matter if one had just been run 3 days ago. We run a new one because a LEDS is only as accurate as the day it was taken, frankly. We will pull all of the administrative records we have regarding that individual and pull them into play, as it were, to compile in one area. That's going to include all prior licensing records, any prior complaints, any prior board actions. That is put together and then provided to the investigator.
They're not in one file drawer with that particular name on the file? Or
no.
On the computer with that name on that person's file?
We have been working to get our database full of all types of cross-referenced information. That is a process. The database was first instituted in 2000, and we continue to improve it. So we can make references to know where they are, but often the documents themselves are still hard copy, and they're often off-site if necessary, if they're old enough. So we would be gathering documents which would be in-house, we would be gathering any electronic documents we have, and we would be gathering any documents that, due to their age, were stored off-site. And that's what was compiled together, and that did take those days to put together.
We have a couple of other folks that have come to testify, so I really appreciate you coming. I hope, going to take up some significant time in the interim, not looking at the nursing board, but looking at the whole question of the issues we raised today relative to boards and how they balance those things. And I really do thank you very much for coming. I'm glad you brought your lawyer with you today.
They're always nice to have.
And we have Elizabeth Fogg and Alicia Jubin.
Hi, Representative.
Both.
Greenlee, I've never had this kind of experience before.
so I'm quite a greenhorn at this. The reason I am here...
Start with your name, please, and address,
today,
if you would.
My name is Elizabeth Izetta Fogg. I live at 1750 South Troutdale Road in Troutdale, Oregon. I came today because I have been a registered nurse for 30 years with a flawless nursing record. I have never had a complaint filed against me for anything as far as work is concerned. And yet I was forced into the nurse monitoring program based on complaint that I had migraine headaches for a period of time that required emergency room care, and I was treated for an auto accident and required emergency room care. And for that, I was brought into the Board of Nursing, told you're an impaired nurse and you need to go into this monitoring program. And I have been accused of not cooperating very well with the monitoring program. I don't understand what it was that I didn't cooperate with, but I don't believe that I belonged in the monitoring program in the first place. I was professionally managing the lactation program for St. Vincent's Intensive Care Nursery and had a very high-level position as a nurse there. They desperately wanted me to come back to work and I was unable to after, because of the monitoring program. I had a history of chronic pain. My chronic pain was managed with pain medicine, but before I set foot into a practice area, I went to my boss and obtained permission to work with that particular medication. I had some work restrictions about not being alone in a patient care area, etc. I abided by all of those restrictions, never abused that privilege whatsoever. Because I was put in the monitoring program, my pain clinic decided that I must be abusing the narcotics somehow, so they took me off the narcotics. I was unable to return to work because of the amount of pain that I was in. The Board of Nursing stepped in and told I found another physician to provide pain management for me, and the Board of Nursing stepped in and said, don't provide pain medicine for her. We believe she's a substance abuser. Basically, I have had my life, I finally surrendered my nursing license this month because the Board of Nursing, it became too painful to try to work with it. So, I just came in as a representative of someone who, on the other side, it doesn't work in one direction. There are people who are being injured by this process who are not guilty of what they've been accused of also.
Ms. Fogg, who brought the complaints against you? Do you have any idea?
Mount Hood Medical Center filed a complaint about the migraine headaches. When I was going through the change of life, I had a lot of migraine headaches, and it's well documented in my physician's medical notes that this was going on. And about the same point in time it was around Mother's Day in 2004, I was rear-ended in a car accident and had head and neck injuries and was treated for that and was reported by a legacy physician as being a, quote, drug-impaired nurse for being treated for the accident. And there was no opportunity to explain. I wasn't told by the Board of Nursing. I wasn't allowed to be told who complained, so I didn't know where the complaints came from. So I had no way of countering them with the truth of the fact because I didn't know who had complained. And so I felt very helpless with the situation. And, I feel very badly. It's been a good career. You know, I've been a good nurse. And
one of the things we're going to take up, and we had a lot of discussion on during the session, is the question of making sure that professionals have due process when they're
when they're about to be forced into a monitoring program. And I think your story has been very helpful for that discussion. And I hope you're making a living without being a nurse.
Disability. But I would love to be able to go back to nursing. It's my calling. That's I've fine. Done it for 30 years, and I love it. So.
Thank you very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
My name is Alicia Juber, and I thank you, Chair Greenlich, for convening this hearing. And I know there's not much time, so I'm going to try to go very fast, but I have something I wish to read.
We can go to 5 or 10 minutes after the hour.
Okay. But I've been struck by some things that have been said today. And I'll just kind of read them off, and then if you have questions about any specific ones. It spoke about, DHS spoke of reporting, like if something has happened within a nursing home, or reporting a mortician who has not done his job right, or reporting whomever, whatever board might be covering. What if they don't report? What if the staff doesn't report? What if they're afraid to report for loss of job? Then what do we do? And I wanted to state, addressing the task force meetings, and I attended some of the Board of Nursing task force meetings. And I discovered there they were not open to discussing issues that pertain to the nurse monitoring program. They were usually tabled. And as to the audit that was spoken about by Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard and also Joan Bouchard, the audit only covered a year. 05, that's what I was told, and all the recommendations only cover what transpired in 05. And yet there are some other allegations that go back before that, much less the one that happened with my story. And I didn't understand why they didn't go back further if they were doing an audit of how to make their program better. It struck me it should go back beyond 05.
Ms. Jimis, why don't you tell us your story?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I'm probably confusing everybody anyway. The story of actually what happened to my father, kind of what I'm... Okay. In 1998, my father was, in my opinion, murdered in a nursing home, Sheridan Care in Sheridan, Oregon. He was put to sleep along with three other people. One was dying until a nurse was no longer put on schedule. This nurse was on an encumbered license due to dangerous behavior that, from what I've been led to believe, was known by the Board of Nursing. And yet he was allowed to work in a nursing home. I'm talking about 1998. This was reported 8 months later because a nurse saw me and said, I can't handle the guilt. So she told me what had transpired. I thought my dad's death was very sudden. And she told me what had transpired. I called the Board of Nursing. She said she's going to call the board. Nobody had called. Nobody had reported the alleged crime or alleged abuse. At that point, I went in. There was an investigation started, and I was told there'd be a hearing within a month. In 2 months, I was told I could not speak with that investigator again. I had to speak with her supervisor. 4 months later, I was told I could no longer call the Board of Nursing. I had no right to know about any of the investigation. I then went to other means to try to find out what happened and how justice could be done in this case. And what I found out later was the Board of Nursing allowed this man's license to lapse after 4 months. I do not know, I do not believe they invoked or whatever that is, the emergency order, upon immediately hearing what this man did. I don't know that. But I believe it was not immediately. This is a serious allegation by a nurse who worked for this man. So if I can kind of jump to this, because it might help a little bit with the more present, sensational or not, I'm very glad Peter Korn started articles in March of 06, because he brought up problems that had been addressed regarding the Board of Nursing, a nurse who, I guess, went to Texas from here, got a license, and, quote-unquote, murdered somebody. In the summer of that year, I spoke with Joan Bouchard and Kim Burning both, who were there in 1998 and were aware of what happened in the Sheridan Care case. and they assured me repeatedly that policy and actions at the board had improved dramatically since 1998 and the deaths of these patients, and that two laws had been instituted as a direct result of this case to protect the public, to assure public safety. So then when I read about what happened in prior to 06, all I've seen since has proven the direct opposite as to now the board case validates. If an agency repeatedly makes mistakes that threaten public safety, those in charge must be held accountable. How else can trust in the system, I don't care which board it is, but how else can trust in the system be maintained? I lost that trust after the years of struggle I've experienced in the wake of my father's death. But I'm really angry. I'm especially angry right now because of what I've just heard here at this hearing. Please forgive me. I'm going to say something very unkind. But the seeming incompetence and irresponsibility at the board has again put lives in danger. I realize this only as a fact-finding hearing, but after seeing the results of last year's fact-finding hearing, that was with Pete Shepherd and Joan Bouchard, Board of Nursing, I maintain my concern for public safety and the essential accountability necessary for true change. Accountability for specific cases and actions taken or not taken, and the courage, as it takes me courage to sit here right now before you, to do what is right to protect Oregon citizens. It's what is needed. No, it's demanded expeditiously, even if some allegations come in the form of an anonymous letter. There's still allegations. They need to be looked into after all that has transpired, such as you're talking about. Don't you look at something if you know a person has a criminal history? Don't you red flag it? Don't let them work in a nursing home for sure. I respect things move slowly in legislative session. I know it's been real busy here. But when public safety or loss of life is at stake, expedition of change seems paramount. It doesn't require an immediate bill. It does require at least a thorough investigation. Only then will the powers that be see the necessity for a bill. There's only 2% or less of the nurses who are in the nurse monitoring program or even being looked at for disciplinary issues. So I'm a bit offended when I hear about, well, the Board of Nursing has to cover 60,000 nurses. But most of those nurses are wonderful, beautiful human beings who are out saving lives. As the nurse who tried to take care of my dad and was told to give him medication she argued about giving, threat of job loss if she didn't. My father died late afternoon the following day. Thank you, Representative Greenlick, for calling this hearing. And I pray change will come sooner than the 8 years it's taken since my father, John Avery's, death. I also realize I've offended people. Well, I'm offended. My father and others had the right to believe their lives were safe, that their welfare and their health would be cared for. And right now, I do not believe the Board of Nursing has the citizens of the state of Oregon as their first priority. As this was even said here today, what I hear more is protection further of the board, more so even than the nurses. But when a nurse does something like what this particular nurse did in the past, why is she allowed to work in a nursing home? Why has her license not been either put in some major suspension? Why was this man who went to Sheridan Care in 1998, I keep repeating that, because in 8 years I don't see any change. And yet we've been assured there's been change. I was assured. You keep being told, be assured there's been change. We did an audit. I'm sorry, kind of carrying on, but I tell you now, I've become very angry listening to what I've listened to, especially after a year ago this issue was brought before a Senate hearing. And I just pray the state of Oregon citizens start being protected, and the agencies that are there to protect them, who are charged with that duty, start doing that duty. And if they don't, then they best be held accountable, or it isn't going to change. It will keep on happening. And as one said, we don't want to see this happen to another person. I said that 8 years ago. I didn't want this to happen to another person. Thank you very much. And yet it happened. It has happened repeatedly. And this, excuse me, anonymous letter that I've, excuse me, who am I presumptuous to say? I've never been told whether it was true or not. And yet, if it is true, it's an egregious allegation. If it's not true, okay, it's not true. But we better look into why. Why did this person send an anonymous letter from the Board of Nursing, a staff member, afraid for her job? That's why it became his or her job. That's why it became anonymous. All that did when I found out about that letter in February of this year was just ask for more, please, let's do something to protect the citizens of Oregon. So I'm sorry, I'll stop. And if you have any questions, but all I can do is say thank you for convening this meeting. Thank you very much.
Ms. Huber, thank you very much for being brave enough to come. If you think things move slow during the session, you'll see how really slow they move during the interim. But we definitely intend to be doing something about this. Are there any questions of Ms. Huber?
Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, Ms. Huber, and also to Ms. Fogg, thank you very much for coming and sharing with us your experiences. I think these are some of the very reasons why this is very important to undertake this scope of review. So thank you.
Thank you. The public of Oregon, thank you.
Thank you very much. We have I think we're late for our floor session. I really appreciate this. I'm not sure what the nature of the health or committee will be in the interim, whether it will be a perhaps joint health and human services. I think that's not been decided yet, but whatever the nature of the committee is, I hope we can keep moving this issue forward. I think we've heard some very difficult stories today, we've heard of Peter Korn's articles, of which you have one. Sandy's going to make the whole group available. My understanding is there'll be another story in Friday's Tribune that will be will have even more information in it.
Chair, can I
yes,
comment?
Yes, please.
During hearings that we had with DHS over problems that were taking place in caseworkers, a special case review process was called, which involved key people at DHS, from their director on down, several of the legislators, and we went through, actually the file was boiled down to about 312 pages, and there was 10 or 12 of us on this review panel, and we read all of it, determined what had gone on, and it was very open as far as seeing the process, and as a result there's been major changes take place in the agency to see that this kind of thing doesn't happen again. I could see that type of a review process being very valuable if we took a case that was, you know, where there things look like they're one way, and we just privately, confidentially go through everything and determine if what is being alleged is real, and if so, why did it happen, and what might change to avoid these kinds of things happening in the future. And so I would just
The legislators had to get some special status to have access to confidential information, is that right?
I think we just signed a confidential agreement, since we all work for the state and we're kind of the oversight group.
And we returned our documents at the end of our review period.
And these were death cases in that case?
No, they were not. It was
a
child abuse.
It was an adoption. It was a grandmother who was not able to adopt, and there was lots of allegations of self-dealing and so forth in the way that the case was handled. And so it was just that entire file of what happened to this child who was put up for adoption outside of the family.
Great. But there's also this new process on all of the death cases inside.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was instituted DHS. By the governor.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I can assure you the governor, as we heard, is very much interested in this issue. And I think we all take it very seriously. Thank you all coming. Thank you, the board and others who testified. And I'll close the informational hearing of the House Committee on Healthcare again, probably for the last time.
Wow.
You said that once?
Yes, I did.
Thanks.